I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Zeynep Salbi, founder of Women for Women International, an organization that supports women in war-torn regions, including Rwanda, Bosnia, and Afghanistan. Women for Women International has provided over $100 million in direct aid and microfinance loans to women, and Zeynep started the organization after her own experience with oppression. She grew up in Iraq, where her family had close ties to Saddam Hussein. Her father was his personal pilot.
My mom was very passionate that I had to be strong. As a teenager, she would hold me and shake me with passion. She says, "You must be independent. Never cry. Never let anybody touch you or talk with you in the wrong way." She even told me I should never learn how to cook or clean because no man should expect me to do that just because I was a woman.
Coming up, we'll learn how Zeynep Salbi started Women for Women International from scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Zeynep Salbi, the founder of Women for Women International, an organization that assists female survivors of war in countries including Rwanda, Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Women for Women has provided over $100 million in direct aid and microfinance loans, and the organization also helps women start their own small businesses. Zeynep grew up in Iraq, where her family had ties to Saddam Hussein. Her father was his personal pilot. She is the author of Between Two Worlds, a memoir that describes her life growing up under Saddam's Ba'athist regime, and The Other Side of War, Women's Stories of Survival and Hope. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you were growing up in Iraq, what did you dream to be?
Oh, well, like as any child and teenager, I went through a whole series of dreams from wanting to be a pilot to wanting to be an architect. But really, at the age of 15, I knew that I wanted to work with women and help women. I remember that moment very, very clearly. It was after my mom made me read so many books about women's issues and told me so many stories of what goes on with women. And I remember she was driving one evening in Iraq, and I told her, when I grow up, I'm going to help women. I'm going to dedicate my life to helping women. And I remember her turning towards me, looking at me, and she says, "And you can do it." And I never forgot that moment. And that has been my journey ever since. I went on a detour here and there, but really the journey started in a very early age of 23 when I started Women for Women International.
Why did your mom encourage you to read books about women?
Well, my mom, I think she wanted to pass on what happens to women. My grandmother, for example, married at the age of 13 to a man older than her. She was an orphan. And even though my grandfather was a nice guy, he was older than her. And she went through a lot of suffering in terms of being under the control of another household, basically. My grandmother made sure that all of her children, particularly her girls, went to school and finished universities. And that's the story of my mother. There was a change throughout a generation. My mom was a working woman, a college graduate. She was a biology teacher. But then she still struggled between the expectations of a modern woman, you know, working, independent, and that she was a wife and a mother. And the expectations of her as a wife and a mother never changed, actually, and never adapted. The other reason is that we were living in war, and particularly with my family, we were very much close to Saddam Hussein's environment, and that meant we were closer to danger. It did not mean that we were actually protected from danger. And so for a diversity of reasons, and all of these reasons, my mom was very passionate that I had to be strong, that I had to be independent. As a teenager, she would hold me and shake me with passion. She says, "You must be independent. You must be strong. Never cry. Never let anybody touch you or talk with you in the wrong way." And she's like, she even told me I should never learn how to cook or clean because no man should expect me to do that just because I was a woman.
Is your mom still alive?
My mom died, actually, at the age of 52. And in the process of her death, she gave me another beautiful journey and gifts, actually. She had Lou Gehrig's disease, and I took care of her the last year of her life. In that last year, she told me my story. Because, you see, I came to America when I was 20 years old through an arranged marriage. And I was very upset that this strong woman, my mother, who told me I have to be independent and I have to fall in love and all of these things, or I should choose my husband, all of a sudden begs me for an arranged marriage with a guy I barely knew and older than me, much older than me.
Why did she do that? Did you ever learn to understand why she did arrange the marriage ultimately?
Ultimately, 9 years later, so I was very mad at her, to be honest. But she cried, and she was like, you have to listen. You just have to do it. At the end of the day, honestly, I was a daughter who did not want to see her mother cry. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. But when she finally came for medical treatment and we knew she was dying, that's when I asked her, what happened? Why did you do that to me? It was only then that she wrote me, because she could not speak at that time. She lost her voice, that she did that because she was so worried that Saddam Hussein, who, again, we were hanging out with him in the weekends and many weekdays as well, started to make comments about me as an adult woman. She just felt it, and she said, you know, she became the lioness mother. You know, I needed to get my daughter out. Mm-hmm. It was interesting because I remember these moments, and I just saw him as my father's friend and an uncle, sort of, you know. So I didn't pay attention to these moments. Mm-hmm. As an adult woman today, I do see what she saw, and I understand. And in retrospect, I think she is no different than mothers that, you know, the images of Vietnamese mother throwing their babies at American soldiers saying, take them. And eventually in my life, I meet a lot of women who offer me their daughters, like, take her, maybe you'll give her a better life. My mom was doing exactly the same.
And was the man an American, or?
He was Iraqi-American, and he was actually everything my mama told me not to tolerate. There was a lot of verbal abuse, physical abuse, dependence on him financially. And it's so interesting because it became a very intensive experience of a bad marriage over 3 months.
And good for you that you got out after 3 months. Other people might stick around, especially wanting to please their mothers.
Well, in these 3 months, Iraq had invaded Kuwait, and I was cut off from my family. I could not even reach them by phone, and I really had to make the decision on my own.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International, an organization that provides aid to women in war zones. So you left Iraq in 1990 when you were roughly 21 years old. What did you do professionally, or what did you pursue?
Well, up until then, I have never worked in my life in Iraq. If you come from a, you know, financially comfortable family, you don't work at all, and it's like socially outrageous. So I left my ex-husband. I had $400 in my pocket. My first job was actually at Hallmark, as a clerk, you know, and I remember being so excited to work. And then eventually I went to the Limited. I did all the things that, you know, I guess teenagers in here do it. I did it as a 21-year-old.
The Limited, the clothing company.
The clothing company. And then eventually I worked in a medical lab. And, you know, but really for 2 years, I'm really working here and there, just earning a living, you know, a translator, an assistant, all of that. It took me, so that's really between the age of 20, 21 to 23. And that's when I decided to start Women for Women. But the point is I had not much work experience at the time.
Right. But when you got your first job at Hallmark, and you mentioned that you were elated because you were working for the first time, was that your state in general, one of kind of zen and happiness having gone through this turmoil? Or what was your psychological state at the time?
Yeah. That time was a very hard time. That time, not only did I left an abusive marriage, and, you know, when I mean an abusive marriage, beside the verbal abuse and the dependent, but, you know, I was also raped in that marriage. It was really a bad arrangement. And not only did I not have any money, mm-hmm. I was cut off from my family. So it all happened at the same time for me. So I remember being glued to the TV stations at that time, or TV rather, and just seeing the Gulf War it was the first time we have a coverage, I think, of a war with all the blue screens, if you remember. And I had no idea if my family were alive or dead. I managed to finally call my mom, or she called me rather the day before the war, and she gave me her will. And she said, I don't know if we're going to see you. You need to know we have this and this and this and this in the family in case we never see you again. So it was a very hard time in my life, actually. It was, I felt abandoned and alone and cut off from my family.
And how much did your own personal experience of conflict and chaos echo the war that the women you support experience.
They're all in one picture. There is no separation, I think. I understand what it means to live in war. Mm-hmm. Now, I lived in a privileged life, nevertheless, so don't take me wrong in here, but the sound of bombs, the fear, the fear of death, you know? And I felt that as a teenager, as a child, actually.
And then even in the United States, the fear of being harmed in your own personal life.
Right.
You seem to speak so freely about what happened. Have you always been able to speak freely about it?
I was embarrassed for the longest time about it.
And then what was the turning point to say, okay, I'm going to open this valve?
One of the very women that I thought I was helping, end up helping me. And this has been really the journey. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write a book on Iraqi women right after Iraq. And I remember my publisher saying, or my agent calling rather, and saying, you really need to write it about yourself without mm-hmm. knowing my story. And I cried. I was like, no, it's not about me. It's about other women. It's not about me, you know. But that day I was in Congo. And while in Congo, I interviewed right after that call a woman called Nabitu. And Nabitu was a 52-year-old woman, homeless, completely poor. She was telling me about how she was raped, gang raped. Her sons were forced to spread their mother's hands and legs open. Her 9-year-old, 21-year-old, 22-year-old daughters were raped, also gang raped in front of her. How the rebels not only raped them, but pillaged everything and they burnt everything. And she said, I never told this story to anybody but you. So I looked at her and said, so I am someone who talks about stories. Would you like me to keep this one secret? And she looks at me, and I never forgot that moment. She says, if I can tell the whole world about my story, I would. So other women would not have to go through what I've gone through. But I can't. You can. You go ahead and tell the story, just not to the neighbors. And I had to drive five hours from Congo to Rwanda that day. And I promise you, I cried mm-hmm. throughout these whole 5 hours because I realized in that moment that this woman, humble, illiterate, poor, homeless, you know, lost everything in her life, has far more courage than I had. And it was a breaking point in my life. It mm-hmm. was like, I can't actually claim to serve the women if I don't act what I'm asking them to do. And that was the breaking moment.
It's interesting. Some people might have had an opposite reaction, which is, whoa, I see myself too much in these people that I'm trying to help. I want to run away from it.
I feel because I lived in fear, in dictatorships, and close to a dictatorship. I mean, I lived in times in which my family was socialized with Saddam, and he would talk about how he killed his best friend the night before, and I would see my parents pale and scared to death. Mm-hmm. So that fear was so much in my DNA. So I really had a choice. Generally, any concept of fear or any trigger of fear, either face it and look at it in the eyes and take a chance that I can actually overcome it or continue to be imprisoned by it. Mm-hmm. Now, in the process of writing my memoir, by confronting my fear, by showing my nakedness almost, you know, I actually protect myself. It was my freedom. I always joke and say I went through therapy and got paid for it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International. We'll hear more from Zainab coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, the founder of Women for Women International, an organization that assists female survivors of war in countries including Rwanda, Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Zainab started Women for Women in 1993 with her then-husband Amjad Atala after she learned about the war in Bosnia. So you decide to start Women for Women International. How did you wake up one day and say, this is what I want to do?
So when I finally moved to Washington, D.C., I fell in love with a wonderful man, and we got married, Amjad Atala.
A Palestinian-American.
And I went back to school. So I went back to school at George Mason University, and I remember a class that I took that for the first time I learned about the Holocaust. You know, they didn't teach us that back home. But that same month happens to have on the front page of Times magazine an image, a picture of a guy behind barbed wires, very, very thin, starved guy, who very much looked very similar images to the one of the Holocaust. So I happen to be one of those people who learn about the two facts in the same month. But people said never again, but it's happening similarly things again, so we have to do something. Anyway, long story short, I was actually at Denny's midnight and talking about how we can help.
And at Denny's.
At Denny's, right.
The restaurant.
The restaurant, yes. So I was at Denny's with my former husband, Amjad, and my brother-in-law, and I was like, well, how about if we sponsor women? How about if we just send them letters, manage to exchange letters between women, show them that the world is still a good place, but then give them cash? You know, you see humanitarian aid give food or secondhand clothes or whatever. No one thinks about giving cash. And with that has a dignity and the integrity to go to the store and buy whatever it is you want. So it was June 1993. September 1993, I went to Croatia with sponsorship funds for 33 women. This is basically the program then and the program now. We ask every woman to send $30 a month to one woman survivor of war and exchange pictures and letters with her if she wishes and as she wishes for an entire year. But in September 1993, I took cash with me and names from American women from all different places. And I was like, this is how we're going to launch it, and started with 33 women. Now, this became 300,000 women.
How did you get the financing?
My former husband and I used some of the savings that we had for our honeymoon because we were newlyweds and we postponed our honeymoon. And then we raised money from, you know, different crowds, really, from Amnesty International Group, Unitarian Church Group. And that's how we started it.
Now, Amjad, you are no longer married, but how much of a role did he play in the early days with you?
He was the backbone of it. He was the one who wrote the incorporation papers. He was the one who got all the logistics aspect of it. He also was the one who worked and earned a living, you know, as I run it full time.
What was he doing working?
Gosh, I felt, you know, Amjad was actually on a PhD track at the University of Virginia, and he decided to drop out and to work really, oh, poor thing. He just, you know, was a temp and was a whatever, different things just so we can earn a living, just so we can do that. So for 3 years, I wasn't earning any living and just doing this. And we were sending 100% of every penny we raised. So we were on the brink of like saying, well, we don't know if we can do it. You know, we were like, we were poor kids to start with, and we were giving 100% of everything we had, and we were really having a hard time survive.
So what was the turning point?
The turning point was I got a check for $67,000, something like that, for Marking Assets. So someone had heard me on a radio interview nominated me to Working Assets. It's a company that donates 1% of its revenue or $1 million of its revenue a year. It's a phone company and a credit card company. Mm-hmm. I honestly did not know about that. But the check came for $67,500, I remember. And I remember looking up this guy and said, okay, I think I'm meant to stay. And that's when I stayed and hired a couple of staff, and it took us the second wind, basically.
This might be too personal for you to answer, but to what extent did the difficulties of getting Women for Women off the ground, to what extent did that cause your marriage to deteriorate?
Not at all. If anything, it was actually one of the best years of that whole period. Was a wonderful years of our marriage. Now, we went through a very hard time financially, but I remember we had no question about our commitment to what we were doing. Yeah. And just no question about commitment to each other. The marriage actually deteriorated in far more latter years when everything was growing and it was okay and, you know, and pursuing different dreams. But that, on the opposite, if anything, it strengthened our marriage, not hurt it at all.
So you received this check for $68,000. Who was the individual who sent it to you?
I never knew. But until today, I never knew who this was. She was a listener, I think, to a radio. I honestly don't know.
By the way, you mentioned, you don't know the woman who recommended you. It could have been a man, right?
Oh, it could be a man. Yes, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, really and honestly, men have been wonderful supporters from President Clinton to Mayor Bloomberg, actually, who have been really wonderful supporters to our initiative.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International, an organization that assists women who have survived wars in countries including Bosnia, Rwanda, Iraq, and Afghanistan. She's one of 20 leaders chosen by President Clinton to work on the Clinton Global Initiative LEAD program. How do you help people logistically?
Well, the development of the whole template of the project came throughout the years. You sponsor a woman for one year only. In that 1 year, she is grouped with 25 other women. And with the 25 women, she goes through two kinds of training. One, an educational program that teaches her really about her rights, her own the value of her, of being her, a woman, and the value of her own contributions, and teach her about the services that are accessible to her. So it is teaching her from her legal rights to her political rights, go vote, to nutritional health issues, to her economic values and the different things that she can do for budget management and things like that. So what we call that an educational program that goes along with very basic literacy and numeracy. Now, we also have parallel to that vocational and business skills training. And we teach women skills that has market demands. And that goes from, honestly, from food to service industries to manufacturing, meaning different things, embroideries and things like that, but much more to sell hats and gloves and whatever it is. We have partnerships with companies like Kate Spade, but also women have their own market locally, to carpentry and shoe production and all of these things. So really we do market assessment and we teach them very, very practical skills. At the end of the year, they graduate, big ceremony. It's beautiful. They get their official certificates. And almost all the women, this is the first time, they get a certificate. And usually they frame it and put it in their living room. And then after that, we help them to place them in jobs, basically, or in income-generating opportunities.
Could you provide an example of how you've helped a woman?
A woman that I recently met in Afghanistan, and her name is Yakuba. And Yakuba was promised to be married at the age of 6, sent to her in-laws at the age of 6. The boy she was to marry was 9 years old. Now, they don't marry immediately. When they get married, when she was 15. And he gets killed when she was 16 and a pregnant woman. So at 16, she is a widow and a single mother living in an abusive household with her in-laws. Poverty strikes and she ends up going and selling hats in the streets of Afghanistan during the Taliban time. And she talks about how the Taliban one time saw her with a slipper, an open slipper, so her toes were showing, and they came and whipped her. But she also talked about how she grabbed the hand and threw it. And when I asked her what occurred to you, what triggered you to do that, and she said it wasn't the pain of the beating, it was the humiliation of being beaten was more painful. Then the Taliban leave and she joins our program with nothing really. She learns embroidery, but she had really particular skills, you know, and so we end up hiring her as a teacher. And she took a loan on the side to start a business. 5 years later, she has $30,000 in her bank account.
We were talking before about a pivot point for you and for the organization when you received your first big check. But certainly now the organization has provided over $100 million in direct aid and microfinance credit. Were there specific allies financially or on the PR front that helped escalate the organization to a whole other level?
Well, there are a couple of pivot points in the organization, few. One was the working assets check. The second was a journalist from AP who did an article about two women, one from Michigan and one from Bosnia, and they were exchanging letters. And that got covered front pages in about 13 newspapers in America. That helped really trigger a whole new wave of media attention, and media has always been really the most important source for people to know about us and to support us. Then Oprah Winfrey Show. Oprah came to us in September 2000, as a matter of fact. I had no idea who Oprah was before they identified us. They identified me particularly. They wanted to do a small segment. It was called Remember Your Spirit segment. And I remember going home and watching Oprah. And I was like, wow, this is an amazing woman. 10 shows later, Oprah was actually a major turning point in the organization. She featured us 10 times, including the very last show as she was ending her show in 2011. And every time, almost every time she featured us on the show, we get tens of thousands of women joining us.
Conrad Hilton being the hotel entrepreneur. To what extent was your mother's voice in your mind while you were launching Women for Women, even day to day?
She caught me once being in Sarajevo during the war. She was in Baghdad. And Amjad told her, my former husband. And I remember getting a call in Sarajevo from my mom. She was livid. And she was like, I risked my life to get you out of Iraq only for you to go to another war? Are you crazy? I remember like just trying to calm her down and feeling I was caught, you know, because I didn't tell her. I didn't tell my family for two reasons. A, we only had 2 minutes of phone calls allowed during Saddam's time in the 90s. So I really had very limited conversations with my family. And B, Saddam was supporting Milosevic in Serbia. So I was afraid of telling them what I did, lest that would put them in danger. So actually, they didn't know the details until she came and visited me the year before her death.
The details of Women for Women.
Of Women for Women International. And I actually remember a couple of weeks only before her death, the Kosovo war started. And I was watching the refugees on TV and the crisis there. And I made a decision that this is my mother. And I'm not going to go. Usually I would go. I would be the first to jump on a plane and say, let's go and see how we can set up. But I was like, I'm taking care of my mother and she's dying and I need to stay with her. And I remember her telling me, go. And I said, no, I have to stay with you. And she says, go. I will wait for you. And sure enough, I went, set up the program over there. And a week later, she died.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International, an organization that provides aid to women in war zones. How is it switching from going from New York City, where you live in Tribeca, to Bosnia or Congo? It must be like a mental seesaw. Or are you able to, you know, step back and be more zen about that transition?
I went through all kinds of stages. You know, I went from the stage of really being very depressed the first few years. I would feel guilty about buying a dress or even seeing water. Then to the stage of anger. I was like, bah, people have so much in here. And if you only know, you can save a whole family for the $300 shirt you have. Then to a stage in which I actually, you know what? The world is everything. The world is dark and light. The world is rich and poor. The world is beauty and ugliness. It's just, you know, so I have no judgment anymore about it. I just live it and appreciate both sides and hope and just really, and so I no judgment actually. On the opposite, I actually always urge people to go and enjoy their life. Just share a little. Just share some with those who don't have.
Where do you feel most at home?
Honestly, wow. You know, I call myself the people of the people of the bridge, those who do live between two worlds. Every country triggers something in me, and there's the food or the smell or whatever that I feel like the home feeling. And I can't deny when I go to Iraq, I'm amazed that country has a ability to grab my heart and just capture it. And there's so much about it that I don't like. It's so hot. It's the environmentally, like the smell of gasoline is really bad. But I just, it triggers, it's really have a strong hold on my heart and I love it. And I think home is where my bed is and home is when I meditate and that's sort of what anchors me.
You meditate. So yeah. For instance, today, have you meditated yet?
Not yet, but I was conscious that I wasn't meditating.
So how about yesterday?
Yesterday I have, indeed.
And how about exercise?
I exercise. I feel very strongly about exercise, actually. And again, this all came really in a learning process because I went through the massacre stage, you know, of, oh, my God, you know, I have so much more than these women, to now, I honestly believe one needs to enjoy their lives. This is about joy and happiness. I love to exercise. I love to dance. I love clothes. I like looking nice. This is not about, there is this whole myth, at least when I was young, you know, in the 20s, that if you are to work on social activism, that you're supposed to be miserable or not nice looking or whatever it is. And I actually have the opposite.
By the way, you know, you meditate, you exercise, and this, for, I don't want to sound too simplistic here, but I have thought it would be so helpful for women and men in these regions to be able to get on an exercise bike for a half hour and let off that steam and clear their mind. It's underestimated how important that is.
I understand it, but it takes such strong will to sort of get out of it, and a courageous will to get out of that imprisonment, mental imprisonment, and because the physical environment is not friendly either, you know. So is it possible, for example, for a prisoner to exercise in his or her small cell? Yes, there are many amazing stories of people, you know, walking steps in their, you know, in their solitary confinement or doing yoga or whatever. Is it possible? Yes. Does it take an amazing mental will to say, this is how I'm going to defeat it? Yes. Does it happen? People resist in different ways. And this is the story that I learned, the lessons I learned. Resistance and heroism is not in the big, grandiose ways. People resist in small ways. Honestly, when I go to Congo and these women are dancing fiercely, and they were just telling me the stories about their gang raped and their breasts who got cut out in the process of raping, I mean, like torture and all of that. And then a few seconds later, they dance, and that's their resistance. Or running, because we do have Run for Congo women, and Congolese women run in defiance, basically. You know, a woman whose rebels cut off her legs, and she put her artificial leg and run with it just in defiance. So people resist. Bosnian women during the war, I asked them, what do you want me to bring next time I come? They said lipstick. Their resistance was in looking beautiful. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, what Women for Women International do is providing that space for women in these women's centers. We have, I call them safe haven for women, where they can maybe not exercise, but move, because we, you know, part of the classes is to have them move or dance or celebrate themselves. And sometimes it's as simple as needing the space to reaffirm and to re-inspire.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
My guest has been Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International. Coming up, we'll hear from Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. They were pioneers behind making chocolate from the actual bean to the bar, and they're part of a group of food artisans who produce their own cheese and chocolate and knives and meats, and they're part of a local barter community in Williamsburg. Welcome, Michael. Welcome, Rick.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Before we get started, I just want our listeners to know what I'm looking at, which is two brothers who have massive beards. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how long it's taken you to get your beards to the length that they are.
Well, originally, we sort of made a wager with ourselves when we first decided to do this. We made a wager that after we would make and sell successfully 1,000 chocolate bars, we were not going to shave. And by the time that happened, we were sort of accustomed to them, and they were sort of part of who we are, and we thought it sort of symbolized what we do, so we keep them, much to our wives, my wife and his girlfriend's dismay. Yeah.
We held true to that, and it took about maybe 8 months before we sold our first 1,000 bars.
How would you describe what Mast Brothers Chocolate is?
Well, simply we describe it as American craft chocolate, a sort of term that goes beyond just being a slogan. Just taking pride in one's work as a craftsman or a craftswoman. you know, that it's not just for my brother and I, but it's for the people that are that work with us in our factory. It's also just people that work in our community, in our food artisan community, or and beyond food artisan community. It's being a part of a community of furniture makers. You know, there's a resurgence in furniture makers. There's a great knife maker in Brooklyn. There's all sorts of great cheese makers, beer makers, wine makers. So whether it's, you know, from woodworking to food, it's a sort of self-dependence and a pride in what you make with your hands.
Rick, before you were making chocolate with Michael, your brother, what were you doing?
I was working in kitchens and restaurants all around New York. Worked briefly at Gramercy Tavern. Worked briefly at Soho House. Worked briefly under Jacques Torres.
Gramercy Tavern, which is owned by Danny Meyer, the restaurateur, and Jacques Torres. He's a chocolate maker.
So what we do is make the chocolate that maybe someday he would use to make his confections with. We are the tree grower or the logger to somebody else, to a carpenter's, you know, creation of something they would make with wood, you know.
And before you were working in the culinary life, what were you doing?
Before that, I was a classical musician. I studied piano and composition and was obsessed with opera. And I always dreamt of actually using a similar approach and mentality and vision to what we're applying to chocolate with opera. I always thought that opera was the ultimate liberal arts education. That's what I'd always say. You can learn everything about life by working in an opera.
Why do you say that's the case for opera, and how is that then carried on to your making of chocolate?
Well, with opera, you're learning about languages, you're learning about history, you're learning about physical building of sets, you're learning about math with the composition of scores, you're learning so much, and you're working with the team, all of that. Well, I think that which you just learn about the necessities of life: food, shelter, music, art. Those are the things. Family, friends. Those are the things you need in life. So to sort of be a proponent of it, that and really push it out there to the public about how beautiful it can be, and how important it is, and how pure it can be. It doesn't have to be so complicated. That's important to me. I'm not sure if I made sense there, but I tried to in a roundabout kind of way.
I think it does.
It. Yeah.
How did you decide to go from opera to chocolate?
Well, it was opera to food, music to food. So I, my brother was living in New York. I was living in California at the time. And I decided to move out to New York and crashed on my brother's couch and started getting into food. Started first, just briefly worked at a local restaurant in Williamsburg, and then decided after about a week or two of that I need to study and really work at this like I worked at classical music. So then I went to culinary school.
Michael, what were you doing before starting this company?
Well, I originally came out here after I graduated from college in 2001. And my goal was to work in independent films and maybe one day be a film producer. And so my path was working in production and in financing and accounting for different films or TV shows.
You're both from Iowa. What did your parents do in Iowa?
Our mother works for the dean of the Graduate College at the University of Iowa, and our father passed away a few years ago.
Yeah, our father was a carpenter, and but he fought in Vietnam and went through the shit, as they say. So he had lots of problems, and her mom was always sort of a champ and grew us, raised us on her own. We have an older sister as well.
What influence did you have from them, if any, in the path you chose? I mean, yes, your father was a carpenter, so there's that obvious link with working with your hands.
Mm-hmm. And that's about it. I think that what our mother taught us was self-reliance and work ethic. I think that it goes beyond stereotype that Iowa boys work harder than everybody else. Mike and I have a sort of unwavering work ethic that we wake up, no matter how much we've fought or how whatever happened in our personal lives, we'll always wake up and get the job done and work, you know, pretty devastatingly exhausting hours.
What was that moment when you both said, Rick, you're living on Michael's couch, and you said, okay, we're going to start this chocolate company. How come it wasn't cheese or milk or butter?
Well, I think that it could easily have been cheese or butter. I'm interested in all of them. and we both are interested in all of them. It was chocolate specifically because chocolate is probably far and away so associated with American culture because of such a favorite food of Americans. And so when we were searching out, we're like, oh, how is chocolate made exactly? After learning about how to make cheese and all these other things, chocolate was the next on the list. So how do you make chocolate? Well, let's go ask. So we'd go to shop after shop after shop, and they'd say, how is chocolate? We'd ask them how chocolate was made, and they would say, well, we put the chocolate in this tempering machine, and then we make these, you know, various shapes or bonbons or truffles. And we're like, no, how is the chocolate made? Chocolate doesn't grow on trees. It's a recipe of, it's what happens after you make something. Mm-hmm. So that's when we realized, no one knows and no one is doing it in all of New York City. New York City? So we were just like, wow, this is insane.
Why do you think no one else in New York City was making chocolate from the bean?
Well, I think that from a business perspective, the profit margins aren't exactly through the roof. You could make a lot more money selling truffles and bonbons and confections than you can making it from the bean. It also, there's no such thing as commercial equipment for it. You can't say, I'm going to start a small chocolate company and then go online and get a couple machines. Almost all the machines that we started with were made for something else. For instance, our first granite stone grinder that we used was made to grind rice, and it was sourced from India. And we had to do some alterations to it for it to be used for chocolate. So it truly is a start from scratch, including the equipment.
We talk about how craftsmanlike you are, and it seems like such an ironically novel concept, you know, in the 21st century, when really you're just getting back to the very fabric of human existence. And it's amazing how far we've moved from that.
It's incredible. Yeah, people go on Brooklyn food tours, and people come with their cameras around their necks, and they're like, look, these people are making chocolate from scratch. We're going to go to the butcher and watch him butcher meat. Wow. You know, it's like,
we really just wanted to simplify everything too, and that's why we're so open about what we're doing and how we have an open factory, just so people can really see what's going on, and there's no mystery behind it, or there's no mystery in the ingredients or the process.
Could you just walk me through briefly the process, how you are going from bean to bar?
We source our beans currently from Madagascar, from Brazil, from Venezuela, and from Dominican Republic. We also have a relationship with some farms in Belize. And when I mention these countries, it isn't just a country. We have specific farms from each country. After we get the beans, we actually just have a big butcher block table. We spread the beans out on there, and we sort through them by hand. We literally go through each bean, and any piece of bark, any piece of just empty husk, any stone, we sort out. After that, we roast the beans. It's a very delicate roast, and we roast in an oven that we got from a restaurant called Marlow & Sons, which is sort of a community hub for food artisans. And we just traded it for chocolate. So it's just really awesome to live in a community where that's possible.
To barter.
Yeah, exactly. After that, we crack all of the beans by hand. We took an old piece of an old grinder or a mill that is commonly used for breaking up barley when you're making home brew, when you're making beer. Then we have to separate the husk from the bean. So we collaborated with a friend of ours who has a business in Red Hook. He's actually an engineer, like an aerospace engineer. So in his, you know, in his side project, for while he's building equipment for satellites, he's just a young guy like us, you know, that's up to no good, you know. So he is collaborating with us to build this winnower, and by winnower I mean a contraption that separates the husk from the meat of the bean, and it's beautiful. After that, you have the cocoa nibs. So,
and the nibs are what are inside the husks.
Absolutely, yep. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis, the foundation of all chocolate. So we have these beautiful granite stone grinders, which is basically a mechanized version of the old way that people may have seen in encyclopedias or books of Mayan women are putting have a granite roller over a granite stone, and they're just going over the chocolate and combining it with cane sugar or vanilla bean. Large commercial companies use stainless steel, And we just find that the stainless steel will basically almost burn out the flavor. So we do a slow 3-day grinding process. Then we add the sugar. We have a very specific sugar philosophy. Each bean gets treated with a different sugar just for flavor to construct like perfect flavor profiles.
When you say each bean, you're saying each bean from a country.
Right, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, or each varietal. Our mentality is that, for instance, Madagascar has a very sort of citrusy, almost like a sour cherry flavor to it, a little bit of a raisin flavor to it, kind of winey. And I love that acidic, pure, clean flavor of it, and I don't want to disrupt it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you necessarily need to use that raw sugar is always going to be the perfect pairing. So in this case, we use something that's a little bit more refined, something that provides sweetness, but not a lot of distracting flavor.
Walk me through the process of coming up with the name for your company. Were you considering anything else?
I think it was pretty, we knew it right away.
I've taken some business classes and in the food industry business classes and stuff like that. And they would always say, you know, whatever you do, don't involve your name in the company, because if it goes down, you don't want your name to go down with it. There's no accountability or responsibility for anything. So that is what I think is so important about calling our company Master Brothers Chocolate and really taking the responsibility of being the face of it. The Master Brothers has other more personal and intimate implications, and that's that our father and my uncle, they're always known as the Master Brothers, and they used to just raise hell in their small town in Primgar, Iowa, and they're infamously the Master Brothers, you know, much to their now ex-wives' dismay. I think that we also wanted to get back that name.
Talk to me a little bit about the dynamic of working with family. When you were first starting out, for example, did you know how you would get along?
On the subway ride over here, my brother and I were talking about what really is it about working with family that draws you together, and what we came up with that you will never fight for anybody harder than a family member, and you will never fight harder with anybody but a family member.
Well, we had been living together for a few years before we even took on this venture, or even had a notion that we'd be starting a chocolate company together. But we had that time of about 3 or 4 years of having many fights. You know, not just mental fights, physical fights. And you know, we got through those, and we still have those on occasion.
Is there a theme to the nature of your fighting?
We don't fight over what we say to each other more so than the way we talk to each other. And the tone of how we talk to each other. And
it's always the tone. It's just the tone.
And then that just brings up, you know, past arguments or fights that we need to steer clear of.
And of course, it's always his tone that's wrong, not mine.
Definitely always Rick's tone.
Because we know that we've survived so much, like, together, just growing up, and also just we've lived through arguing about way worse things than a chocolate company. Mm-hmm. So if we've survived that, we can survive anything. And, but that also opens the door to more arguments. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about the psychology of that, if you know somebody that you work closely with, that you know that you're going to live to see another day, no matter how you treat them, you might take advantage of that sometimes.
Right, because you know you'll never lose them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we cross the line more often than we should. And
welcome to therapy on NPR.
Exactly.
And also, we just had some extreme successes. We are now the restaurant Per Se is using our chocolate, and
Per Se is one of the leading restaurants in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And we have such respect for Thomas Keller and his crew that to me, coming from that from a restaurant background, is like a dream come true. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So. And we're so busy now that we used to be able to celebrate each of these new things that happened. So a couple of years ago, we would, we would celebrate.
After selling 30 bars at an artist market.
Like we did with, you know. And so now we have these beautiful new things that are happening, and we don't have any time to celebrate them because we have the next thing to do. And that really takes a toll. You know, you never just get to breathe and just, that was nice, you know.
Do you have any grand visions for what you'd like the company to become, or are you taking it more on a kind of incremental basis?
Definitely an incremental basis. It's that we've been very dedicated to that and are sticklers to that, because already we've had many, many opportunities to grow super fast and build a huge factory off-site somewhere and all this kind of stuff, and we've deliberately turned it down. When we first started, we were very dedicated to slow growth, just like food should be made slowly, with care. A company should be built under the same manner.
It's kind of like your beards.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Slow growth. Yeah. Slightly annoying and hard to deal with it many times. It is like a beard.
It's my impression that the way you are living is very close to the way that you want to live. Is that an accurate depiction or impression that I get from you, just based on the company that you're building and the website and just my interaction with you, that there's less of a distance between the way you're living and the way you want to live?
I think so. I think that's definitely accurate. I think that part of that might be just the way we grew up, being very content with what you have and appreciative of what you have. You know, we never summered anywhere. We never even heard of the word summering. So we've never desired anything like that, you know. So there's an appreciation for hard work, for working hard. And so since we're doing that, then we're pretty content. I was joking with Stephanie, who works with us, about how I was telling her how I just finished organizing my pantry with my wife, and everything is like in these nice mason jars. Everything is divided up by, like, you know, grains, pasta, all this stuff. And so she started thinking, wow, so your life is, you're making chocolate, then you go home with your wife and you, like, look through your beautiful pantry of old-timey mason jars and all of this stuff. And I said, I had to stop her. I'd be like, whoa, wait. It's not, we'll, you know, we get Chinese food with the best of them, you know what I mean, when we're exhausted. So, you know, we have cable TV, you know. So...
Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
My guests have been Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.